The Sunstone Foundation presents My Mommy Can Cook Too, Reflections on Being an LDS Dual Career Couple. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
I'd like to welcome you to our session on dual career marriage. I'm Brenda Peterson. I'm from Redondo Beach, California, where I'm a manager of a publishing program for Xerox Corporation. What qualifies me to address you today? Obviously, I hobnob with the right people, two of whom you're going to meet and get to know a little bit better, John and Janet Targin. I don't quite know how to define the term leadership, but I do know that these two people have it, and they together are working their way through an experience called dual career marriage. Janet was born in Manhattan Beach, California, and raised there. At the age of 12, she was an exchange student in Mexico. She was a Kimball Scholar at BYU, went to Guatemala for several summers on a Project Guatemala. She has a bachelor's degree in mathematics at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She has a master's degree in managerial economics and decision science from Northwestern University. She's currently working on her EdD in higher education from Nova University in Florida. She's an assistant professor of mathematics at Bakersfield Community College currently, and she's the co-chair of the curriculum committee there, and she's on the executive council of the Academic Senate. She's also the state Academic Senate representative. She's the mom of two daughters and the co-leader of Brownie Troop No. 188. The microphones are not amplifying.
It's just for the tape.
Okay, I'll shout.
Go.
John was born in Chicago and raised there. His parents were immigrants from Hungary, and he's enjoyed Janet's extended family here in the States as they joined in marriage. John joined the church at age 11. He attended BYU and has a degree in economics. He fulfilled a mission to Chile by way of Las Vegas. He's an avid sports fan. He has an MBA from Northwestern University and a PhD in management from the University of Utah. He's currently Associate Professor of Management Information Systems at California State University at Bakersfield. He's recently been the chair of the General Education Committee there. He's also the father of two daughters and a member of Girl Scouts. He coaches soccer. And he said that we could introduce him as the perfect man.
That wasn't just
Oh, excuse me.
That's all Janet wrote the rest of it.
Okay. Well, we'll be viewing these two highly achieving individuals today as we view them together in a marriage. Now, we know what recorded history and literature has told us about women. According to Schopenhauer, women are a trap. For Nietzsche, equality between the sexes is degrading. Marriage clips man's wings. Women are a millstone around his neck. Yet, here sits a man who not only acknowledges that he likes women, he has one as a partner. On the one hand, as we hear from the pulpit, if the ideal is marriage, woman at home, rearing the children, man at work, staying out of the way, then perhaps Janet and John are partners in crime. On the other hand, if ideals vary and the goal is, in the best way we can, to fulfill individual potential in companionship with those we love, then perhaps Janet and John are partners in a grand adventure, blazing their own special trail through life, a trail many of us will attempt to follow. I've always thought that anyone who allows their marriage to be discussed in an open forum is crazy, or else they're very strong and they're courageous enough to let others participate in their experience. And this is what we want to do today. We want you to participate in a dialogue on dual career marriage in the religious context of the 80s and the 90s. So please ask questions and share your views. We've structured some of the session with specific questions, sort of an intellectual version of the newlywed game. And Janet and John have prepared responses without collaboration to present their view of an issue from different sides, point and counterpoint. But as we pick up momentum, we want to generate a more free-flowing discussion. So please be prepared, in the style of Oprah Winfrey and Phil Donahue, to share your views and contribute to the panel with your contributions. Now, by raise of hands, how many of you already know John and Janet personally?
Just to let the rest of you know, we have lots of relatives and friends here.
How many are related?
Okay, and by raise of hands, how many are related?
To me.
Okay, now I feel that this gives us enough information that we should be able to draw them out rather effectively as we go along. And John and Janet, as there are many sensitive areas in any relationship, please feel free to say, oh, give me a chance to think about that for a minute, and we'll take our cue and we'll move on to calmer waters perhaps. Okay, to begin with, about 65% of women, including here in Utah, are already in the workforce. But we should really categorize those people, and I'll do that in three ways: single-income marriage, dual-income marriage, and dual-career marriage. Single-income means one wage-earning career spouse and the other spouse not in the acknowledged workforce, sort of a nonprofit organization providing home management, maintenance, and child care. Work that is absorbed without pay is known as an opportunity cost in business. And these are significant costs in a marriage. For example, if you were to hire an au pair or a nanny for your children, this is a non-managerial task, you could expect to pay $10,400 a year plus room and board. If you were to hire someone to provide housekeeping duties with slight supervisory duties, you could pay maybe $13,600 per year. A home management position would be worth about $20,000 to $30,000, depending upon the size of the household, the scope of the responsibilities, the budget, and if the person had a degree or not. Now, a dual income marriage is one wage earning career spouse and one wage earning spouse whose job is not considered a career. It's considered supplemental income. And this person usually absorbs the opportunity costs in the marriage. Now, a dual career marriage involves two career wage earning spouses. I'm very interested to know who absorbs the opportunity costs in a marriage like this. So question number one was intended to allow them to provide us a glimpse into their economic realities of their everyday life. So I'd like Janet and John to please describe a typical routine at the Tarjan household and in their professional day.
It's unanimous up here.
Were you
going to
stand up?
Okay. No, I'm going to sit down. I'm just microphones if you're going to share. Okay, Janet usually gets up first, and I try and sleep while she's getting ready, and then get up usually before she's out the door, and the children also wake up early. Sometimes they watch TV or play or whatever they're going to do. More often they're sleepy and not getting out of bed until they have to get dressed and eat breakfast. Janet usually rushes to get out the door because she teaches, usually beginning at 8 o'clock in the morning. I usually put away the dishes while I'm making breakfast and lunch for Kristen to take to school. I get Kristen out the door, read my papers, get ready for school. I had to define our family. We didn't do that. Kristen is our 8-year-old, and Aaron is our 3.5-year-old. Kristen's just entering the third grade. Take Erin to preschool or a sitter. This year she's going to be going to preschool 5 days a week. Up until this time it was 3 days a week. Janet or I pick up the children after school. I usually get Erin, or I get it more often than Janet does. Janet picks up Kristen more often. After school I often run errands, sometimes do shopping. Janet usually makes dinner, and I put her around or watch TV. Janet typically gets the kids down in the bedroom. I come in for kisses and sometimes a song, depending on how tired Janet is. Sometimes Janet and the kids fall asleep together, usually with Janet on the floor and maybe one or both children on the floor as well. I stay up later working on things or watching TV, usually do some dishes at the nighttime and load the dishwasher. However, most days are not typical due to weekends, holidays, teaching schedules, conferences, meetings, special activities, sports, church, house guests, Janet's schooling, Girl Scouts, AYSO, school open houses, etc. And I said here, the important thing for our family is that we try to do as many things together as we can, and that Janet and I share as many activities as possible. That's more of the flavor of doing things together and being together a pretty significant percentage of the day. I also said I don't think I have many typical professional days either, and that's due to the nature of my career. But the days that I do have are taken up with preparing for and teaching classes, preparing and grading assignments, in committee meetings, community and professional volunteer work, student advising, meeting and talking with faculty about curriculum, dealing with administrators, which is not insignificant, doing research, and basically doing whatever needs to be done by a university professor.
All right. It sounds like we agree on the day. I get up about 5:30 or 6 in the morning. Usually Kristen is the early riser, the 8-year-old. Do I sound louder as I stand? No? I'm just good sitting? Okay. Kristen's the early riser, like I'm thrilled that she and Mom are just alike. So I get up at 5:30, and I go to my office and start working, thinking that I'm going to have an hour to myself. And Kristen comes in about 6 o'clock and either sits on my lap and I continue, or doing things, or we sit and talk and have a quiet time, which is very valuable for both of us. Or she gets a little cuddle and then says, "Can I go watch cartoons?" And I'll say, "Sure." Gives me another half hour to get something done. So the morning, Chris and I have some special time together that she really, well, we both appreciate. About 7 o'clock, it dawns on me that I've got to teach in an hour. I have a problem with time management. So at 7 o'clock, I go rushing in the bedroom. This is when John says he tries to sleep while I get ready. I've already oftentimes gotten Kristen a bowl of cereal or something to start her off in the morning. I'll get ready and get out the door by about 7:30, at which time, if John isn't already awake and reading the newspaper, I will let him know it's his turn to take over. I'll wake him up as I leave. I'll say, I'm going now, the kids, and I'll let him know what they're doing. Erin, our 3-year-old, is a better sleeper in the morning. So sometimes she's awake when I leave and sometimes she isn't. It depends on the morning. So that's a typical one. I get to school and I teach or am in office hours, often helping students for typical day. So it's a very demanding, quick energy kind of thing. I've always got people in my office asking questions. I've taken on more responsibilities on campus around this coming year and in the past year, so that when I don't have people in my office, I'm often on my way to a meeting or doing something there. But I get done by about 2 o'clock. Also, last year I started having a twice-a-week racquetball game with another math professor on campus. So on 2 days of the week, I'll get to lunchtime racquetball game. We get done about 2 o'clock. So in this way, we're not typical of the dual careers. We're both college professors. We both have quite flexible schedules. If children get sick, we can rearrange our days. But I get off and get going toward picking Kristen up at school. After school, I often pick her up, or I call a friend and they have her walk home with their children. Brownies takes up my every Monday afternoon for a few hours, and it's delightful. We have started lately, as Erin's gotten older, John will pick her up and drop her off at Brownies with us so that both kids are there with me. Anyway, early afternoon, I pick up the kids, or John picks up Erin and I pick up Kristen. And then we have the evening time or early afternoon, late afternoon, I'm home with the kids and John is at school. So we have a staggered schedule there. Evening, I do the dinner usually. Sometimes things like Taco Bell help out. And we have a neighbor who got divorced about a year ago that is part of our family oftentimes. She has 2 boys, ages 3 and 5. And so John will often teach at night, and I'll call Terry, and Terry and I will join forces for 2 days a week or more, even when John's home during the evenings. It'll be the 3 of us that are deciding what to do with our kids, our combined families, which is a lot of fun. Then the evening times, I do get tired early, and I do fall asleep in reading to the children, although lately I've gotten better at not doing that. And then after the kids go to bed, we have time to either talk or get more work done before going to bed. So that's a typical day. Yes, we can go on.
Okay, does this match, as you were growing up, is this what you expected to be doing when you married and did you expect to begin a career in this manner?
Okay, my mother was at home, and I thought growing up that is exactly what I would do. I thought it was delightful coming home. We could smell the bread cooking, a couple blocks away. We knew Mommy loved us. I remember in 5th grade, my mom started being more busy with Relief Society things after school, and I was very resentful. I was the youngest of 4, and I knew that she'd been home all the time for my older brothers and sisters, and at 10 years old, I felt like I was being neglected. And so in fifth grade, my mom met me at lunch every day, if you can believe this. And we played softball, just the two of us. So I grew up thinking that I would provide the same kind of experiences for my kids. I've provided them ones, but it's been very different. Anyway, so thanks, Mom.
I grew up with a single parent, and my only sibling was about 10 years older. So my mother was... louder, can you hear me? No? Yes? All talk louder. I always get accused of talking too loud in my classes, but that's when I'm pacing up and down and getting excited. Okay, my mother was a single parent during most of my childhood, and my only sibling was almost 10 years older. And therefore, I grew up basically as an only child with a mother who was gone most of the time, but who often came home for lunch. But I don't know why I give that background. Just to say that I always, in my idealized mind, I would come home early evening to have my children, especially daughters, I always envisioned having daughters, would come up and rush and jump on my knee and give Daddy a big hug and a kiss. I would make the grand entrance and then, I guess, sit down to dinner. So it's very different from my vision of what my life would be when I was significantly younger.
Who would you say is the dominant person in the marriage?
My mother-in-law.
Oh, God.
No, I have to do it first?
We've been talking all week. Who's going to go first on this thing? And so we said we'd let Brenda decide. Now we get here and we're still pointing at each other.
Dominant in what way?
Well, Janet, I feel like when you got married, you changed your name, and you are now Janet Turgeon. That seemed to indicate a change in status in your life, and so does that indicate that John is the...
Chest number three.
Yes.
All right.
Go ahead. All right. Oh. So, I just want to know,
okay.
Does that mean...
I am.
It depends on what we're talking about. If John knows something's important to me, then I get my way. Usually I don't know if it's my position in family or just my personality, but I'm happy as long as I'm with other people, and it doesn't really matter to me what activities we're doing or what kinds of things we're involved in. I'm just real happy being involved, and so oftentimes he gets to make the decisions on those. But that's partially my choice, just because I like being with people, I like to be involved with people, and if he has a stronger feeling on something, that's fine with me, and we'll do it. Now, sometimes that causes problems because he wants me to direct things more often.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's been a little bit of a course of friction over the years, is that I've tried to push Janet into more things like calling and making arrangements for electricity and gas and friends and things, where she's been a little more reluctant to do that. Is there a question?
Oh. Yeah,
anytime.
Anytime.
I have two questions. My wife also has a degree in mathematics.
All right.
She found it very difficult. BYU in the 1960s, she had two professors actually call her in and encourage her to get into CDMR or some other field. The influence in her life that spurred her on was her father. I'm wondering what brought you to a degree in mathematics. Was dad?
Dad, would you like to answer that? No.
Why were you able to do that 10, 12 years?
Are being encouraged to.
There are a few women in mathematics classes at BYU these days. That's my first question. Why don't you answer that in the
last? Let me handle one. The question is, what influences for the person asking the question? His wife also has a degree in mathematics. It was her father that was the influence in her life that kept her going at BYU, even when professors suggested she go into CDFR or other things. And so for me, what in my life kept me going? I wasn't always going to major in math. I didn't know what I wanted to major in. And I did choose BYU largely because of the Kimball Scholarship that got offered. They talked me into it. I kept taking math because I wanted to keep my options open. I really did not know what I would major in. I started out as an engineering major. I figured if I didn't start that way, I would never change my mind that direction. So I took 18 units of engineering and decided the first semester that I didn't want to spend another semester doing it, let alone 5 years of my life and then a professional career. I didn't like it. But I didn't know what I would like. The next semester at BYU, I took CDFR, which I loved. I took elementary ed classes. I kept taking math and Spanish. Those were two things that I felt I had
already strong interests in, but I didn't know how I'd use them. I had a minor done in Spanish before I ever chose the major. I thought about elementary education. I thought about all kinds of things. I do love kids. I like the involvement there. I think something that made... I also had this... I was at BYU in the 70s, and my roommates... I can remember them saying, "What are you taking math for? You're never going to need it," quote unquote. My math teachers, however, were very supportive in the 70s. They may have kept me going as much as anything. My freshman year, I was asked to be a TA in mathematics, and I taught at the math lab as a sophomore. They kept me real involved in what was going on there, and they were very nice. I decided to marry John quite young. I didn't have this in my plans at all at all of people would doubt that at BYU. But my mom and dad got married at 26. I figured I would do the same or later. I was not a big dater in high school, and nor at BYU my first semester. And I decided to marry John when I was a sophomore. So my junior year, I transferred to University of Illinois, and I had not chosen a major yet. I flipped through the catalog and found an extremely good major that I could get done that year because, as everyone knows, when you get married, you might have kids right away, and then your chances to get done with college might go by the wayside. So I found mathematics was something that I could do and get it done, and I'd be proud of doing it. I've always liked math, and that is the influence of my father. That's why we all laughed. When we were little, he would change popular songs into math songs. And if you want to hear those as a question sometime, sure, we'd love to do one for you. but we didn't have a radio in our car, and when we travel on vacations, we grew up in L.A., my mother's twin sister lives here in Salt Lake, and that's a lot of the family you see here. We would sing math songs in the car a lot. It'd be fun to talk to her. Is she here? I've got nothing but positive feedback about my choice, so that's the difference. That in the 60s it was more difficult to choose that major.
And that was in the 60s.
Yeah, I think Brenda has some interesting insights on that too. But one of the questions, question number 6, was: you have lived in numerous places. Have you perceived a difference in the level of support or non-support of your dual career lifestyle? So I think I'll speak to that. I'm talking about church rather than others, because it's a little different. In North Shore War, which encompasses basically the Evanston campus of Northwestern, we were considered a little bit of an oddity. Most of the women would stand up in fasten testimony meeting talking about how when we graduate, well, Janet was the only one who could really say that because none of the women were in school. Their husbands were. However, they accepted us. I think some people were a little bit puzzled at what the heck Janet was doing. I mean, why was she doing this? This was silly. It didn't make any sense to them and their worldview. When we were living in Monterey, I think we had a lot of warmth, a lot of loving acceptance, but we weren't a dual career couple. And I think we were viewed quite differently. We were viewed as maybe people that had a lot to offer the ward and did a lot, were active and involved, but yet we weren't a dual career couple. In the short time we lived in the Manhattan Beach Ward in Los Angeles, I think we had an acceptance by most, but still I felt some trepidation of others in approaching us because of the type of relationship we had and the type of goals that we had. And I don't know whether it was threatening, but it's still a little bit of not relating to us. In the Garden Park Ward here, which for those of you who don't know, it's just right by East High. It's kind of old families where people come back to testimony meeting and say how they've been trying for 25 years to move back into the ward, basically saying now that I've made enough money to live here or something. There was a complete acceptance and support from the older members of the ward. There was some friendship, but still a lack of relating by the younger couples that were close to us in age and had children the same ages. In Bakersfield, before our ward split, I think there was a little bit more of open atmosphere. But our current situation, there's some friendship, but I think a great perception of threat and lack of understanding, lack of ability to relate to who we are. Well, yeah, I haven't seen that so much from... I haven't perceived that. You know, Janet probably ought to speak to that. But I would say the one...
Yeah.
Well, the one thing, though, that, I mean, there's that milieu there. We had this high council person come through whose daughter I coached in AYSO soccer stand up and tell all the men in the audience, which was the majority of them, if their wives worked outside of the home, that their eternal salvation was in peril, which I guess President Benson basically believes. And, you know, in that environment, of course, there's no support.
Yeah, I was going to say, as far as the material things, we were in school for so long, and our tastes are not very high expensive tastes. So we have not been a threat to people in that way.
People did not envy us materially, believe me.
And they have been in our homes, and they see the couches that we got secondhand when our first child was born and that we still have in the front room. Actually, we just got a new couch this year. we're moving up, I guess, on this one. It might change in the next couple of years. It has not been a threat from us, although I hear that comment when women say, well, I would work, but really I can get by without working. The concept is that the only reason to work is to get after those materialistic things, and if you want to work, you are therefore a very selfish person that has these materialistic goals in mind. And I come from a different point of view. I did not want to work. I was very happy at home. I like that situation. I had a very pushy husband that wasn't satisfied. I didn't ever keep house, whether working or not. And so when I when I was at home, I wasn't keeping the house clean. I wasn't pulling my weight. So I figured out that it'd be...
That was just my perception. I can't believe it.
He thought he'd be the one saying this.
So did you feel like you had...
I felt like I would be better off working, getting the esteem in that way from my husband, and then we would share on the at-home responsibilities. Honestly? Okay, the question is, how did I react to President Benson's talk?
Some stuff. One
month. How did I react to President Benson? Hang on a second. I didn't go to that one. I missed it. Right. I missed it. I didn't see the pamphlet. I totally missed it. A friend of mine, I heard people talking at church, can you believe this? I talked to a friend from Monterey, so I can't believe he told teachers and nurses to stay home. We need those in our country. I talked to a lot of people who reacted violently to it, and others who quit their jobs, stayed home, and found good, successful things coming out of it. And so I heard a lot of things. I didn't read the pamphlet, I didn't listen to the talk, until I was asked to respond to it at a Sunstone thing about a year and a half ago. And then I did my homework. I thought, I better respond to it, then I'd better see it. I was asked to respond to Levina Fielding Anderson, who responded to the paper. So I figured before I read her paper, I better listen to President Benson's, and then I would read hers. So I checked the videotape out of the library. I watched it, partially in disbelief by the time I saw it. A couple of comments. Other ones were, you know, fine. We're used to those things. Then I read her paper, and then I responded to both her paper and the talk. And that the paper I delivered at Sunstone about a year and a half ago is where I started focusing on my own points of view. I started analyzing my own situation and thinking about the feelings I had. And it was in writing that paper that I first became aware of other reasons that I am working and why I will continue to work. And there were several pluses to working that I wasn't aware of before having worked. You know, staying home, I couldn't see any of those positive things. After working, I see a lot of positive things that have come about in our marriage and in our children's lives that I wouldn't have ever tasted if I hadn't been working full time. Yeah, you can. And that'll be coming out. I just got it took me a while to get it to Sunstone. They got it back to me, and we sent it back to them. So it'll be coming out in the very soon issue. And it's called... What some of those things were? Okay. A big one was self-esteem. I had good, you know, I've talked to friends and they say, you've always had good self-esteem. So, it's never been like it is now. I didn't know how good it could get. I didn't know the positive strokes that you get from your boss or that you get from your people at work that, you know, when you get the little things, the paycheck that it comes, that didn't mean anything. I knew it didn't. And it came with my name on it. Wow, was that meaningful? I no longer felt like I had to ask for buying things. And I was told always, don't ask. It's your money, too. I've got a very supportive spouse in that way. But, you know, it's different when you're the one earning it. It took me a couple years anyway of John saying, Janet, you earn money. Don't ask me. Use it. So self-esteem, the financial thing is nice. I had been the biggie. Depression. My mother has suffered from depression. Our entire family has had problems with depression. You know, Mormon women in depression. I wanted desperately to avoid that in my future. I saw a big reason for the depression in my mother's life, the ultra dependence on my father and his income. He's in business for himself, sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down, and I saw that as being a very big problem. I wanted to avoid that kind of dependency. I was already worrying about all the future things that might happen as a young, you know, early 20s mother. And I found that as I worked, the worry about depression went away. That was a big reason. Another plus from working that I didn't expect was the fact that I had been a worrier. I worried about everything, and in the paper I said I worried about, you know, getting hit by a car, having strangers take the kids, breaking arms, breaking legs. My husband would run away from me the minute he met someone else that was attractive. All the worries that could possibly be worried about, I worried about. And I worked for a few months, and I remember driving home from work one day. I was going across town, and I remember thinking, I'm not worried anymore. And I remember thinking, it's not even that I haven't had time to think about it, because people, when I mention that, people say, oh, you just don't have time, you're too busy. No, because I was busy before, and I, you know, was worried. Those worries were completely lifted, and I don't know if it's part of mainstreaming, becoming a part of society, that I'm not as afraid of it anymore. There are nice people out there everywhere. They aren't all the bad guys waiting in boogeymen closets or whatever. I don't know what all the reasons are, but I am not afraid and I do not worry like I did before. So that has been the biggest thing, I think. I no longer worry about fidelity. I trust him. You know, I trust me, I trust him. There are all kinds of things, but those are the big ones. Can you think of another one I said in there?
No, but I had a comment.
Go ahead.
I think it's illustrative of some things, and maybe it's a common experience for many women, especially talented women, that Janet did not view her potential. Just like this paper, she says for the first time she started being introspective and thinking about her own motivations. Those types of women aren't trained to do that and socialized to do that. And I pushed her I kind of volunteered her for
this.
And have maybe been pushy. Janet uses different words now, being supportive rather than pushy. But kind of helped move her in that direction. And after that, I think she always has more than fulfilled everyone's expectations. For example, in teaching has become, you know, in 2 years was the equivalent of the goddess teacher there in the math department. I mean, the people had a tough time choosing between the two of them. And has a lot to offer, and that paper was very well done and spoke to a lot of women's experiences. But Janet did not see that potential in herself, or at least it was latent. And anyway, I just wanted to make that comment, that I've noticed that as she's fully capable of meeting challenges and doing things and being a productive member of society, of influencing things beyond the scope of our family, which is, I think, how she viewed herself. I think many women find themselves in that situation and don't view their potentialities.
I said this was the, oh, hang on. This made me think of one other thing I said in response to President Benson's talk. Levina Fielding Anderson concentrated on the idea that there are different situations, we need to be aware of different situations, don't make people feel guilty. My concentration, I agreed with what she said, and we both focused on experiences we've heard from other people. My big worry in President Benson's talk that said, basically, mothers, you have no other role that is worthwhile except to stay home, make beds, clean house, and make meals, and provide a loving atmosphere for your family, which are very valuable. I'm not belittling those at all. It's just that we can do those, and there is more to do. My biggest worry there was I was working with beehives at the time, and I was watching these 12- and 13-year-old girls coming home with D's on their report cards. And I thought about my own experience, even though I got the straight A's and was very conscientious in school. I thought about how, as young women, we are not taught that we need to find out what our interests are. We are not told that our interests are at all worth organizing or evaluating, or our life goals are worth putting on paper if they do not match the manuals. Some of us, for some reason, and I can't figure out, well, family role models, I guess. Some of us go ahead and do well and succeed in school and go on to college and do things anyway. But many more I see that say, if I'm not going to use the degree, why should I invest the time in that? Also, the big fear is if I am not taught as a young girl that my own interests are important, then I think what happens is what we tend to do is wait until we find our spouse, and then whatever the spouse is interested in, we will become interested in. At least I perceive that as being a danger. Instead of what I think would be the ideal, developing our own interests, find out what we like to do, develop our own future career paths, and hopefully a spouse will come out of those interests, and then we'll share much more. Go ahead. What was your question?
Shine their shoes for priesthood meeting.
And if, so the question is, how do we train the men to do that?
Okay. The question is, what has it been in my makeup that's made me more egalitarian, I guess, or view life as more of a partnership rather than a fulfilling of roles? And how is the second part of that question was, how has that affected my callings in the church? Let me read a question that one of the ones that Brenda prepared. It said, describe the three most influential individuals or experiences. Oh, I didn't read the experiences part. Oh, shoot. Okay. In shaping your personal and professional identities that have made you who you are. Well, when I looked at the personal, I you know, this is difficult to do. Of course, I mean, this is almost masochistic to try and analyze yourself, or maybe even be in a session like this. But I looked at, for personal, my relationships with women and what has shaped that. And there are a lot of influences. You know, right here, I said, other than my wife and mother-in-law and maybe her twin sister and family, which, I mean, that has been very significant, but I can concentrate on before, well, not even before that, maybe concurrent with that, but start with my mother, which, of course, everything starts with, for especially for young boys, right? She has a strong personality. However, she had grew up as a single parent, which probably contributed a lot. I saw my mother working and doing things and being very capable in many ways. However, she had very little time or emotional capacity to meet my needs. And so I guess maybe, I don't know how that influenced it, why I wrote it down, but I think it shaped what I wanted to do as a parent and maybe seeing what I wanted my wife to be able to do or me be able to do as a father. Sonia Johnson, although I hope no hackles rise up, spoke at Northwestern to a women's group. I think there were some other LDS people in the audience, but it was a small audience. It was a rainy night, and I was definitely the only male Mormon there, and I'm sure there were only one or two other males. She talked and laid out the world for the first time. Janet likes to tell about this. When I came back, let Janet tell it.
Sonia was speaking at Northwestern. I had just come home from a week-long field trip, and I came home with a friend, and I missed this.
I did not have a positive view of Sonia Johnson.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
John. This was 1980. Spring 1980. Yeah, we were naughty and even going, I guess. No, John did not have a positive view of her. He wanted to go see who she was because my parents had seen her, talked to her, and adored her, and he wanted to see why she had made such an influence on the country. I mean, why had she hit the news in
such a big way?
And I wanted to go hear her too, but again, our initial response was not a positive one. I missed it because I had a friend that needed to talk. She dropped me off, and we sat and talked in my apartment. I remember checking my watch every half hour, thinking I could still get there, and then finally thinking, I'm not going to get there. And she finally left, and about half an hour later, John came home. He was dripping wet from walking home from Northwestern in the rain, and he looked like he'd been hit by lightning or something. His chin was still dropped on the floor, and he walked in with his hands like this, and he said, I have just seen the world through the eyes of a woman for the first time. Okay. That is possibly the single most influential thing that has happened in either of our lives. Because I was not there, John was 10 miles ahead of me in feminism and every other aspect that would change our lives. You can take it over. He, from that point forward, wanted to make sure that he did not get in my way at all. And not only that, but he was going to provide whatever experiences would be possible. So, Sonia Johnson, thank you. Here's John.
Yeah, I went on join now.
Can I interject something here? I tried to do a profile on Janet and John, because we're talking about John's makeup, and I think it's slightly different from the normal profile that we get. In a recent study,
because that was a very recent study.
Dr. Willard F. Harden has just written a book called His Needs and Her Needs, and he's come up with what he thinks is the needs of everyone. We all have the same kinds of needs, men and women. What it feels, though, is that men have slightly different priorities in the way they prioritize what they feel are needs for them. In his marriage practice,
Brenda, you want to talk about what the list of needs are?
Okay, they're admiration, affection, an attractive spouse, honesty and openness, family commitment, conversation, domestic support, financial support, recreational companionship, and sexual fulfillment. The reason he came up with the list is some way to address this to help people better address the needs inside their marriages. After he had polled his clients, these were how the needs came out on her side. Most of the females in his practice listed affection as their first need, conversation, then honesty and openness, financial support, and family commitment. While on the male side, he was hearing that their first need was sexual fulfillment, recreational companionship, an attractive spouse, domestic support, and admiration. Now, you may or may not agree, or if you were to look at these yourself in your own way, you might come out differently. I asked Janet and John to rate the priorities of what they felt in their marriage were their highest priorities, and unbelievably, the top five that each one came up with, that Janet came up with and John, were exactly the same. And they were...
We didn't talk.
They did not talk or compare notes. Honesty and openness, family commitment, affection, conversation, and recreational companionship. Both of them identified those as their top five priorities. And there were only two areas. They also, Janet said what she thought John's highest priorities were, and John said what he thought her priorities were. They only had two. John felt that admiration was a higher need in Janet than she had rated it. And what was the one you rated? Janet rated sexual fulfillment in John as a higher priority. So I want to know what that means.
Show the cartoon. These are from a booklet, a humorous booklet called Myths About Working Women. Oh, you didn't do that one? Oh.
No, there's this book about working women.
Is that Mike?
Right there.
There's a book about working women. And there is a perfect one that is not here. But here's one way in which John and I are not the same, or not typical, I guess.
So you can get a flavor of the book.
It's a great book. The author is Ivory Publications. I think it's... I don't know who the author is. Do you have it there?
We can do that afterwards.
Yeah, okay. Always Have Husbands Who Help. Well, we should put on the tape, too. Is one... We're looking for the one that says, working women always... are never too tired for sex. Is the one we're looking for, I think. And it's got a woman draped across the bed asleep, and the husband in his robe with a towel around, in a romantic mood, has one arm under her, and the other arm is holding up her limp wrist like this. And he is looking longingly at her. Working women are never too tired.
And Janet does fall asleep very early, quite often.
I get very tired.
Okay, that's the thing about these lists. There's the socially desirable aspect and what's fulfilled in our marriage and what isn't. But I think I still think it's fairly accurate after I saw Janet.
The point of the exercise, according to the psychologist, was to point out that, now Janet felt that sexual fulfillment was higher on your list, so that's the point of discussion. If that was a higher need on your part or on her part, and you weren't perceiving that.
Somebody wanted to come in, and they're peeking. Oh, maybe they just like the cartoon. Anyway, I think that I probably am a more feminine male. I become that way more. Well, there's a little thing I do when I teach organizational behavior, and there are stereotypical feminine traits and stereotypical masculine traits. And when we took this years ago, Janet came out as a high female, moderately male female, and I came out as a high, very strong masculine male, moderate female male, and I think that's changed over time. But anyway, okay, that experience with my first brush with feminism, high school girlfriend's mother, who was a very strong, very talented woman with a career. She taught kindergarten, or still teaches kindergarten, who did many, many things well. And that strong women, for some reason, and I don't know why, maybe the Freudian could tell me, are very attractive to me, and strong personalities in women. And she was almost an ideal to me because she could do so many things well, but yet was very loving of her family, very, very concerned. It was kind of like my second mother during high school because I had a working mother and she was active in the church and my mother wasn't and that type of thing.
But still, that most men are terrified and absolutely frightened of women who have any strength at all.
So why are you attracted to strong women? It seems like most men are terrified of that. Go ahead, John.
Oh, God, ask a psychoanalyst. Okay, well, yeah, let me finish this, and then I'll answer your question. I'm not there yet. And then the last one was Mrs. Gretz, who was a woman who was my babysitter when I was younger. No formal education, but a very strong personality, a very active individual, very loving and caring, and I guess, I think, you know, in my makeup, they're all there as role models. The question was, well, what can we do? How can we train up men to be supportive of women and accepting and that type of thing? I really don't know the answer except to have role models. And if we have, if everyone grew up with a mother who was loving and concerned, I think Janet had a very loving, nurturing family, both father and mother, but yet very talented individuals that did a lot of things, were very involved, served others, served the community, and I think there's that modeling. In my case, I'm not exactly sure, except I think I have a very strong conviction of right and wrong. Most of the pain I've ever felt in my life is when my values have contrasted with those that I see promulgated in the church, cultural church or whatever you want, or doctrinal church or leadership church. And I viewed this, when Sonia Johnson said this, like a revelation, I said, this is right. You know, I've been wrong all my life and I'm repenting maybe. You know, it's like the missionaries that I went out with who were there repenting and they worked twice as long and would fast twice as hard and everything else because they thought, well, if I do good here, I'll make up for all those rotten things I did. Well, maybe that's, you know, all the girls
that
dunked in the swimming
many.
Pool that said stop and I kept doing it.
Yeah, Sonia was excellent at describing experiences, and one of those was when she first met her husband. The reason he made such an impression on her was when they were at a swimming party or something. She said, please don't splash me, and he didn't. The fact that he respected her wishes and he saw her as a female as having needs that she could express and they would be what she meant. She wasn't playing games. And another thing that she says, just to give you a feeling for why she's so good, she's an English major that it was excellent putting words together. She describes how we as women are taught that we should be able to hang around and watch while our boyfriends fix motorcycles, and that should be just a neat thing to do all day long. But we would never expect to have them sit while we're sewing a dress and sit and just provide conversation for us because we need the companionship while we're doing this important project. Those are just a couple things I think of that she's explained so well. You say, yeah, that puts it into words. So that's why she had an effect on us.
Yeah, what was this? I forgot the second part of the question. No, I'm sorry.
Church callings.
Oh, church calling. Yeah. Okay. There's a comment that Alice Miller has written a book called The Prisoners of Childhood, which gets into the psychological aspects of children being raised in different types of home with different role models and how that affects them later in life. But to address the question of church callings, my friends who I identified with on my mission, the friends that I went to business school with are all stake president, bishop, counselor, high council. And I was much more interested in the church. I studied more. I was more obedient on my mission and did all the right things, and I'm not that material. And so I guess... Well, yeah. Well, how I define myself. I mean, there was a very kind of a heart-wrenching experience when finally, after all these years, never talked to a bishop or a stake president or mission president. I figured, well, I don't have any problems. I don't, you know, that I can't solve myself. And I finally went in and made these confessions. No, I don't know if it was confession, but poured out my soul and said how difficult it was. I said, I always envisioned myself being a bishop. And because I was always trying to do the things, have the experiences that would help me be a better mission president, bishop, whatever. And I finally came to the realization that I'd never have that opportunity to serve in the church because I teach organizational behavior and I don't buy into the hierarchy. So, and I'm kind of an oddity. And in this ward, because it's maybe the ward I'm in now, because it's less educated, I think people are less accepting. They when I substitute Sunday school, everybody loved it, but they in elders' quorum, they don't know how to react to me.
Go ahead, make your comment.
Well, let's ask another question.
We've got half an hour.
We've got half an hour, and we've got about four questions we haven't spoken to.
I'd like to follow up on just something. We're on role models right now, and then we'll take the next question. I took the liberty of interviewing John and Janet's children to see what kind of a view they were taking and how they were viewing the economics of their situation, because I have heard that in a marriage where a mother works, the children suffer. So I said to 8-year-old Kristen, I said, well, what do you think of your mom and dad? They pled almost total ignorance to what John and Janet were doing. They didn't know, they weren't talking about their work. They didn't talk about who did the laundry, who was cooking, really. So I took a different tack, and I said, Kristen, now, what would you like to be when you grow up? And she said, a teacher, definitely. I said to 3-year-old Aaron, and what would you like to be when you grow up? A mom, she said. Wait, says Kristen. What do you mean? How are you going to earn some money? Babysitting? And I said, well, now, Kristen, what do you mean? She said, well, you know, all work and no pay is a housewife.
Oh, it's on our refrigerator.
That's on our refrigerator.
So then I tried to explore. I tried to explore a little further, and I said, well, what do you think a housewife is? She said, well, oh, I think it's, you know, it's kind of like a hobo. So whatever is going on in this kind of a marriage is affecting the children. And I would like to ask Janet and John, do you think your children are suffering because of what you're doing?
Okay, let me go first on this one. I want to comment on this. We had an overnight sleeping party for my daughter's 8-year-old birthday. And it was at the sleeping party that the title of the thing got made. In the morning, John likes to cook pancakes for all the girls when they sleep over. John's always wanted to be one of the girls. He does a good job with our daughters. So he always cooks breakfast for them. Well, one of the girls asked my daughter, well, does your daddy do all the cooking? And she said, no, my mommy cooks too. So that's where the title came from. At this sleepover, they were eating their pancake breakfast, and I overheard my daughter and her friends, they were sitting around the table. I overheard one little girl named Laura, who's in our ward and our brownie troop, said, I'm going to take a break after high school. She's 7 and a half, almost 8. These are the second graders just finishing up. And she unfortunately was sitting between my daughter, Kristen, and her friend, Misa, who turned at her and said, I don't remember who said what, but this was the conversation. What do you mean you're going to take a break after high school? And she said, well, I'm going to be tired of school. I'm going to take a break after high school. And they said, you've got to go to college. You can't, I don't know what you're going to do in life if you're not going to go to college. This is my daughter and her friend taking over on the conversation. And Laura said, well, I'm going to take a break after high school. And they said, well, I can't imagine what you think you're going to do if you don't go to college. I can see you as a teacher. Yeah, I'm going to be your teacher, kids, but I don't know what I'm going to teach you. They start whining. Anyway, it went on and on. I was amazed that in second grade, these girls have already decided what their life goals are. It may change several times as they go along, but they already at least have some direction as what they think is going on, and it's very strongly shaped by the home life. I was thrilled that my daughter had a companion there who also is sharing in those goals. Now, what was our question?
Non-LDS. Japanese-American.
Japanese-American friend, very high scholastic values, also in our brownie troop this year. What was the question I'm responding to?
Are kids suffering?
When Brenda asked me this first over the telephone, I responded with a, no, they're not. Every so often I have this thunderbolt hit me, you know, personal revelation, whatever, and one of them was the driving home from work and thinking, I'm not worried, I'm not afraid anymore, and this feeling of personal awareness. So I had one of these this past year that hit me, and it was this, Kristen is doing real well in school, really well, and it suddenly dawned on me that it wasn't because of me that she was doing real well. I did real well in school, but I always gave all my credit to my parents. I mean, I learned to read when I was 2 years old. My mother was a third grade teacher. We had math, we had reading, we had everything done right from day one. We were raised in the 60s, and education was utmost in home life then, as far as, you know, giving the right opportunity. So I'd already always give my parents all the credit for that. My daughter's doing every bit as well as I am, and she didn't learn to read till she got to school, except for a few words. I think one of the big benefits of my being quite busy has been that when Kristen has successes, I view those as Kristen's successes. And when my children will have successes, I give them credit for it. It is their successes. Also, the flip side of that is if they suffer failures, I can let them be their choices and their failures. And I think that is one of the ways in which, for some reason, this question, are your children suffering, it made me think, no, wait, Kristen's successes and Aaron's successes, those are theirs. They're not suffering. They're doing very well. They are very delightful children. They're friendly. They're much more outgoing than I ever was. They're also sweet and kind to their friends. They are directed toward the future and toward goals types things. They like to think about things. Kristen is a delightful conversationalist, our 8-year-old. We talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. They're happy. I think if they're happy, I'd have more of... Did we get that? More guilt feelings. But because they are so happy and so self-assured and so comfortable with friends, and we have friends over all the time in the afternoons, I don't see them as suffering at all. Now, there are weeks that we'll go through that are more demanding weeks. And at the end of those weeks, we all kind of take a deep breath and think, wow, we made it. But I think those weeks happen in everybody's lives, whether working or not.
I want to jump on that one first. Sorry, okay. Lou, and I'll... What were you talking... Oh, success and failures. One thing that we talk about, we see a family that we kind of adopted for a while. They're going through financial troubles, a church family, and emotional troubles and marital troubles. And one of the things we see there is that the parents are making up for their successes by putting pressures on their children to succeed in performing arts.
Making up for their failures.
Yeah, I think so. And that's anathema to us. Anyway, I answer this question, no, definitely not. They have many activities, more parental support than other children with the mother, quote, at home. They are healthy children who have high self-esteem and are successful. They have many friends. I said, however, there are many times that I fulfill the mothering, in quotes, function. Obviously, I don't think they are suffering for it. Mom has been gone a lot the past summer, about 5 weeks out of the summer this year. I believe it is a positive thing to have an independent female role model, as well as having dad at home and taking care of their everyday needs. The children, especially our 8-year-old, do occasionally complain of missing mom, but I believe that Janet sometimes wishes they missed her more when she is gone. I know I wish they missed me more at times when I am gone. We can both function without the other in a family context. Would our children prefer to have mom home more? Our 8-year-old would. I don't think that it occurs to the 3.5-year-old, but she has had more dual parenting from day one. Still, I should make it clear that the 8-year-old sees as much of her mom as any other 8-year-old I know of, except when Janet is out of town. And let me say that I don't believe there's been a field trip since Kristen's been in school that one of us hasn't been there, mostly me. I played Santa Claus at school. Janet is the Brownie co-leader. I coached AYSO soccer. So our children have more parental attention than any other children I know.
And we both go on field trips when we can.
Yeah,
that's real
right.
Fun.
Yeah, the expression was of a dual career mother said that our situation is unique and that all children suffer a little bit when parents are gone. And I'd say, yeah, but there are a heck of a lot of children that we see, especially in the work context, that suffer having mom at home. And I think that there's only 24 hours in a day, and there are lots of needs to be met, both for parents and children, and everybody has to find their own way, kind of. And I don't want to monopolize this, but I think that was the point of Janet's response to Levina's response to President Benson's talk, is that there ought to be avenues opened up for people to fill their needs and not feel constricted by one model, which definitely doesn't correspond to the demands of society today. And I would like to see parents that love their children, who have children with high self-esteem, not feel guilty. And people who have abused their children in other ways but yet fit the traditional family role model not feeling guilty when they should.
I noticed your husband left before you came clean.
I have two children, a 2.5-year-old and a 7.5-year-old, who generally I don't feel have suffered, but there was a year in there that I wasn't doing too well that they did. However, I remember reading
my mother reading to me, actually, when I was in junior high, something that has stuck with me that I firmly believe. And that's the best. It was in a research. I wish I could find the paper. My mom probably has it filed. But the best mother that they had at that time, that was early 70s, maybe probably 1970, the best mother is one who wants to stay home and does. But very, very close to that, in researching with the children and how they did in school, how they were emotionally mainly, was the mother who wanted to work and did work. Then way down the list was a mother who wanted to stay home, I mean wanted to work but stayed home. And then the very worst one was wanted to stay home and had to work. But the children, the two top ones, where the mother was doing what she wanted to do, there was very, very little difference. What really counted was how the parents were interacting with each other and how the mother, especially the mother, was interacting with the children. That was the biggest problem. By the time my children had the problem was when I was having a problem. I was feeling guilt trips from the outside. My husband and I were having conflicts quite a bit at the time. That's when my children really, I noticed the suffering. When I have been fine, they do fine. And I feel that's unfair because when my husband has problems, it doesn't seem to affect him much. It's mainly when mom does. But that's, whether I like it or not, that's the way it is.
That's a neat comment to have made because I remember reading somewhere that the happiest children are those who have happy parents. And also that if children are seeing their parents happy in what they're doing, they will tend to grow up and seek things that make them feel happy also. So I have a lot of talking with Kristen where we're doing the go team go type talks, you know, the pep talks, and I tell her how lucky she is to have me for a mommy. And I tell her, I mean, we got to get this message straight through. And I tell her how lucky she is to have John for daddy, obviously, but I do enforce the mommy kind of thing. And because I like you, Kristen, because I love spending time with you. You're one of my best friends. Anytime I can, I like spending with you. And you're also lucky because I've got such a neat job that people like me when I go to work, and I like what I'm doing at work. And so there's a conversation going there that I do take on with the kids. I think they need to know that I do like what I'm doing. I get tired at times when I get grumpy and yell. It's not always their fault, the children's fault. And I point that out to them. So I think sometimes it's important to have those conversations with junior high school age children or little children, see what effect that had on you in junior high. We talk about it a lot, and Kristen will often come up and give me a great big hug, and without having talked about it for a week or so, say, Mom, I am so glad you're my mom. I think verbalizing things like that helps.
Yeah, one of the things I say, one of the traps that's easy to fall into when parents are tired and things don't go right and you're sniping, and there are some things, we haven't gotten to that, but there are a couple of things that we disagree and bicker about. Mainly clutter and family, the household organization. But it's easy to fall into kind of convicting the spouses in the eyes of the children or finding support that way, and I think we've done a good job of avoiding that and building up the other one. The other thing I never threw out about children suffering, Kristen and I play games together in cribbage. She's a fantastic cribbage player. And that, to me, is, you know, here's a child who views a father as a friend, and that is kind of unique, it's difficult in today's society.
And John loves doing puzzles, so while I'm tinkering around trying to clean up the clutter, John will be working on a puzzle. It's his speed, and the kids will each get out one, and our three-year-old is incredible on puzzles, and Kristen loves doing puzzles. So the three of them will each have their own puzzles out, and they're talking, and we're all talking while they're doing that. Anyway, those are fun things.
Can we have one more comment?
Sure. And then I want to throw... I agree, and I will say I was very happy while I was at home, and I did not want to go out and work. No, that's good. I'm glad. The fridge, that was a joke. I put other cartoons on the fridge. I've got something else that's... Okay, well, maybe I'll remove it when I get home.
Well, Jen, the comment on the fridge, all work and no pay as a housewife, I don't think that's demeaning, and when I I'm home with the children doing the laundry and washing the dishes. I try and do it happily, and not that that's demeaning or a bad thing.
And actually, in a way, right, and that is the message. I think the point there is, too, part of the reason I liked it so much when I saw it was all work and no pay as a housewife points out the fact that Brenda was pointing out. Brenda and I say we all need wives. There is so much work that is done by housewives that we do not as a society recognize. that I think we need to start recognizing. I'm glad you brought up the comment because I do not in any way mean to demean people who have chosen to stay at home. I have friends, many friends that are my close friends who have chosen to stay at home, and I think they would cite me as one of their biggest supporters. I give them positive strokes. I tell them what a neat job they're doing, and you do that with my mother, I know. Brenda does. There is an awful lot of work that is being done that is not recognized and not appreciated
because it's not included in the gross national product. We do not define it in a business way, and I think that's what we were trying to point out. There are some...
Can I ask specific questions about household tasks? Who does the laundry?
I do. I do the laundry. John does the dishes.
I have been known to run the washing machine, but it's her major responsibility.
John does all the dishes, and I have been known to do that sometimes, too. John does usually,
I do
once in a while. I do the bath. No, we both do the bathtub.
She does the toilets.
I do the toilets always.
Dirty toilet doesn't bother me that much.
Okay, when you are both sick, who gets to take the nap?
John does. Except when
I do.
I'm real sick. Me, Janet? I still do a lot of the household chores. Yes, I don't do as many as John would like me to do. I will be soon. Do I hire a housekeeper? And I will be soon. I hope. I've been saying that for a year and a half, and I haven't yet. But then the other also on doctor appointments, I usually do that. Sometimes I can't because I'm teaching, and John will do it. Oh, and I do most of the phone call arrangements. Part of that has been a hangover from when John was trying to make me be more independent and self-sufficient.
She does the insurance and therefore does most of the doctor.
Well,
John does.
Who balances the checkbook? John does.
I pay the bills.
John pays the bills. I think I always feel like I'm doing more and John may feel like he's doing more. So...
Well, that's one of the things we need to be introspective is trying to figure out how we decided on these things and we fell into them. We've never had a budget and we've never sat down and had a family council
that's
and decided who did what.
Else.
And that's one of the unfortunate things. What?
So that's another way in which we're probably not typical.
Yeah, we're not very good Mormons.
Okay, but then what do you argue about?
Clutter.
I grew up with a European mother that had an immaculate household and... Janet's makeup is not that same way.
I grew up in a house with four children in one bedroom, and we each had one drawer that was ours. So that is a different environment.
Yeah,
we got used to clutter, and I do not notice it. I'm getting better, but that doesn't bother me.
Yeah, but, you know, of course, I think the good thing is let's have a point-counterpoint and get out the knives, and, yeah, I do more than 50%. I mean, I'd say most of the vacuuming, but Janet does it sometimes. Yeah, I'll see. Yeah, I
feel like
I
do
her.
Most of the... yeah, she's pretty good with the vacuum cleaner.
But you know...
She's old
those
enough
of us
to
have washed windows.
Him.
I do the yard work. I take care of the automobiles. I clean Janet's car every week before she takes it to work.
He does all the outdoor things.
The physical labor. I rewired the house. I do most of the household maintenance and changing things around and things like that. You know, from my perspective, I put in the sandbox with cement, and I put up I did the mail type things too. So, I don't know if it's 50%.
Is it your expectation, though, that Janet keep the house clean?
He is very clean.
My expectation is that Janet be more like me and my desires for lack of clutter and cleanliness.
Yes, what? We both agree.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, it's whatever, and I don't know. Again, this is a very idiosyncratic thing, and I don't know how it applies to other people's experience. But when I walk through a room in the morning, I always perceive myself as picking something up and putting it away and grabbing things and doing that. And Janet, of course, sees the things that she does. And we don't really talk about who does how much.
We both take care of things as they arise. We've got wonderful children that
our children
do stuff like this.
We're lucky.
You can't say, wait until dad gets home.
No, I don't.
Dad is anathema in our house.
I'm going to throw a few of these up because we got them.
But Brenda has to ask that one.
Brenda's going to ask a question. Okay. Can I just flip these by while we're talking?
Yeah. Janet, put some of these up because I think they do show the dilemma and the pull on the working parent.
That says ice cream there. Children, working mothers have children who make their own breakfast. One child with ice cream and one with chocolate syrup. Very happy. Okay, go ahead. Have self-cleaning bathrooms.
Have self-cleaning bathrooms.
Working mothers always have time to shop for the family.
Who does the grocery?
John does. I make lists.
She resents me when I make her have things to make.
When he says, "You make a list and I'll go for you," I think, "You make the list, I'll go for you." for me, the hard part... He is faster at doing the shopping. For me, the hard part is the organization and the management part. And if he would help on that, there's the fun one. Always look perky at the office. John does usually, and I do once in a while. He has a more flexible schedule because of working at the four-year institution. He has more days off.
I've had sisters in my office before. I don't know if Janet has. But I work closer to where we live.
Yeah, we've got a house near where he lives. This says always have time to study the morning newspaper. Don't care about promotions. Just work for the fun of it.
Okay, we wanted to get into one other area. The American Medical Association has determined that sex is hereditary. If your parents didn't have it, chances are you won't either. So I wanted to get a question that would help, that would get into an area in which inquiring minds need to know. And the question is, what kind of relationships do you have with the opposite sex? And who are you attracted to? Do you ask your spouse to limit their associations with colleagues of the opposite sex?
I didn't get the attracted part, but this is what I wrote. I tend to prefer the company of females and find them more interesting. Due to the composition of our faculty, my collegial relationships with faculty members tend to be limited, with female faculty members, tends to be limited to committee work. But the attractive one, there's a strong blonde female who's on the committee who I find, you know, attractive as a person, but I guess maybe she reminds me of Janet, I don't know. However, I have many female students. I would have no hesitation to have lunch or engage in any other activity with a woman that I would with a man, although I don't tend to do much with women other than the two close friends that Janet and I both share. She described one to you. Yeah, both very strong, athletic type women. I have very open conversations with both of these women and consider them to be at least as close as sisters. I have not attempted to limit any of Janet's relationships. In fact, I try to encourage the one she has with males because I don't want her to think that I resent them, which is there's always that sexual tension. And, you know, we're kind of feeling our way through this and trying to make sense of it, so maybe I'm pushy again. She has not ever tried to limit my relationships, although I think that she is more likely to resent any close relationships I might have with members of the opposite sex than I would be of hers. And she probably wished that I'd resent them more.
Used to.
Okay.
Now that I have them, I don't.
You need to answer that, Janet.
I need to answer this?
Yeah.
Question number four.
Do you want me to repeat it?
No, I got it. Okay. What kinds of relationships do you have with members of the opposite sex? Do you ask your spouse to limit their interactions with colleagues of the opposite sex? Do they ask it of you? I think my answer would have been very different when I was at home. I think immediately after getting married, there's this vision that we have of our spouse will satisfy all of our needs that we will ever have in life from the opposite sex. Before getting married, my friends were always males in my classes. I studied with male friends. I met them at the library, and my best friends for studying were always men. After marriage, and I was still an undergraduate, I have male friends. Then I had male and female in graduate school. But in church social life, which was our major social life, I was expected to be female-oriented friend-wise, and John was expected to be male-oriented friend. It was strange. At school, I'd run into people in our ward, and I could talk to the men and say, "Hi, how are you doing?" Ask questions about kids or whatever. I would see them at church, and it was as if neither one of us existed. I did not fit into the spouse friendship. I didn't know the wives as well as I knew the husband, and so at church I didn't exist. That was part of another question I never got to answer. Anyway, immediately after marriage, I think we have this vision that we will now just associate with our husband or wife as the member of the opposite sex. And I limited my friendships with males. About a year ago, I went away to school for the first time, and I made a very good friend that was male. He also is a teacher at the school I go to. And that friendship was fantastic. We hit it off right away and became very close friends. When I got home, John was very supportive of that. We've kept in touch by electronic mail over the year, and then he was my teacher this summer. And the friendship picked up right where it left off. We're fantastic buddies. I have three best friends other than John that, you know, aren't family members. Two of them are male, and one is female, the friend we've already talked about. Oh, yeah, my typical day at work. I never mentioned how I'll probably have lunch with Bob Schiffman. Boy, someone got real worried out there. No, I have this friend that I described that I've met in the summertime. It was about a year ago I finally realized I need male friends, too. And it's been real fun. About a year ago with this friend at school, and then at my college last year on the Academic Senate, I met someone that I've known, and we passed in the halls and said hello. I was on my way to a meeting where we were discussing the Myers-Briggs type inventory test at a women on campus meeting. And on my way, I said hi to him, and he said hi to me, and he said, where are you headed? I said, I'm on my way to this meeting, and I started telling him about this Myers-Briggs inventory. We started talking, and we stood there and held up walls for an hour and a half. This was last fall. I never made it to my meeting, but I made a best friend. He and I have just had a blast together at school, and I came home and told John about this neat friend I had. John has been very supportive and not threatened by it. Yeah, I say he went home, talked about this neat friend he made, and his wife was a little worried. We were smart on that, and right away it was the four of us doing things. And so the four of us have gotten together. We ate lunch or had dinner at their house the other night. And so when you got this worried look on your face when I said, you know, he's part of my typical day. We have offices in the same building, and we will talk. It's probably a couple hours a week we'll spend talking to each other.
Yeah, I was just thinking of Terry, one of Jan's favorite comments. I looked over at Terry, who's our friend, who is the single parent with the two boys close in age to our children. And I said, Terry, you're like the little brother I never had. And she said, well, you're like the big sister I never had.
Terry is the only girl with two brothers older, two brothers younger, and yeah. She does provide a fun.
And I do want to be one of the girls sometimes. I mean, I enjoy that in the women's conversation. I think Janet feels the same way about men, and I don't know what that says about what we saw in each other, but maybe, I don't know.
Yeah. I used to be much more threatened about female relationships for John having them than I have been since becoming so secure in my own. I know that bad relationships are out there and available. I mean, adulterous relationships. I know they're out there. They're available. I've seen them and been invited into some kinds of things at conferences. But because of my own ability to keep people at arm's length and to talk and be friends, I now realize that I can trust myself and I can trust my husband. And those worries, too, are gone and those fears are gone. So that I also encourage friendships and things. I think we're both smart and we're going to stay away from the problem situations.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left, and I was wondering if you could each, if you had some advice to give to either young couples who are just starting out or people who are in school or those with children, what advice would you give if they were contemplating a dual career marriage?
I'm supposed to think.
I guess the final things I want to say is that it is difficult. One of the things that one of the members of the audience wanted me to point out is that my father, he committed suicide. I guess he was a very sensitive type of person, and so maybe the sensitive side of my personality was inherited. Or I always thought of myself, my image was being insensitive and things, but maybe it's because I married into a family where feelings are more important than they were in my family. But I would love to have friends and role models in the same situation working through the same types of problems. You know, I think we feel threatening to people because we seem to be happy and well-adjusted and doing something that's very foreign to them. But I never hear anybody say, it's just like women, there are women that work, they're always accused, but nobody says, well, maybe they're hurting too. And it would be nice if some people were concerned about our needs and relationships and maybe gave some support to that. And if we had some male role models. The panel last night or the night before about men and their insecurities and all that, well, I never even thought of those things. It's just like women like to come to conferences because things are vocalized that they never thought of before. Well, that was the same way for me. And there's a lot of things like sexual tension. You know, we're not brought up to relate to women. I mean, if you're relating to someone and you like some woman, then it's a lustful relationship. I mean, that's the way men are brought up. But it doesn't have to be that way. And I see very few contrary role models. I mean, Janet's father is very much that way, I guess, and some other men that I've known. But
very much able to make friends with women without it being a lustful relationship.
Right, exactly. And that ideal. But there aren't very many men out there. And so I guess it's kind of like my hope for for all things, like all social changes, that eventually it'll happen. It's slow. And maybe ours is the first generation. I guess that one dedication that Sonia wrote in her book said, and we can't remember, Jenna forgot to bring it, I guess, or I forgot to bring it too. But anyway, it said, I came first.
It's at home on the show.
It said something like, you know, good luck on the road of a new way of men loving women, or women and men loving one another. And really, I hadn't thought about it until maybe the past day, but it really is a road that we're going by ourselves. And I wish that we received more support from people in the church and that they were our community. Unfortunately, we receive a lot more from it outside the church. And if we ever cease our activity, it's because people are loving and supportive rather than threatened outside the church.
Yeah, it is outside the church that we have many peers. Even in graduate school, I remember lamenting that poor John, he has to put up with me being in school too, because everyone else in graduate school, we were both working on PhDs, and the other men that were in graduate school would go home to wives who were home, and they made breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and they were supportive, and there was only one of them doing homework. John and I walked around like zombies as we both struggled through and had a baby that cried all the time. And I remember thinking how poor John, I didn't think poor me, because it wasn't expected that I would be doing this, but poor John, because he was putting up with me. And I had a friend, luckily, who said, Janet, that is exactly what I hope to have in a marriage someday. This was a single male friend, I guess I've had them all along, who saw in what we had something desirable. He said, where he came from Boston, he said all of his friends that were in graduate school, that was the model to be followed, not to be apologetic for. And it really is outside of the church where we find peers and where we find the acceptance for being equals in a marriage and in parenting. As far as advice goes, I would tell people to find themselves and to do what makes them happy. Be aware of the needs they have as you're going through school or something. Look for careers or for things that make you happy, and find people that you are happy when you're around them. I think that will help in any decisions that are made, whether marriage decisions or whatever. Don't sell yourself short on life. I think one of my favorite scriptures, Adam was that men might be and men are that they might have joy.
One last one. I got advice. One bit of advice. Bring up our boys to marry their best friend rather than some possession that's going to make them look better.
Thank you for joining us. Janet and John invite you to continue this dialogue over the next 10 years, and then we'll convene another panel to check up on how they're doing.